fundamental in terms of thought. And it's basically, as we progress, you'll see what we're talking about. How it's important to extract rules and not just learn an idea from an example. Everybody's doing good, or doing well, or both. And we're going to continue. Actually, I mentioned last week that I wanted to just do a review of the, because we did about five verses last week, which was, we saw the theme. I think we really covered them well. But there's also a little bit more to it. And partial thanks to a question that the Francesca had. Actually, put it to the Jewish Times this week, and I'll show you what I'm talking about. So let me know if we're ready to start. Who's online right now?
Josh?
Yeah. Francesca? Carolyn?
Okay, so maybe we'll wait a second to see if Doug and Cal are maybe just getting a late start. Are they in town? Are they anybody here if they're not going to be joining us?
No idea.
No idea, okay.
I asked Rabbi Mann about Jim's question. We can talk about that till they get here if you want.
Sure. I actually put the article in this week that the Jim, I don't know if you saw it in the Jewish Times.
I did, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I saw that. I talked about it with him for a couple minutes. I mean, the one thing that I thought was a good point is, like, the question kind of comes from the mindset that it's a negative thing. Like, you know, like, how could somebody how can someone speak for someone else, like, obligate them to do something? It's actually, you know, done it towards a great benefit. So, you know, no one really asked the question, like, you know, say someone, you know, agreed to receive $1 million and each of their descendants would receive $1 million or something, you know. And nobody would ask, like, how could they speak for their descendants, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That would be a proof.
Because if it would be a negative thing, if you would say, you know, that they would, you know, obligate their descendants in something negative, then you could say, you know, how could they speak for them? Because it's a great benefit. I mean, they're really, you know, they're being bestowed, you know, benefit without any say or whatever. So, yeah, it doesn't really pose a problem, I guess.
No, because since it's not really being given as a choice, so
Yeah, that was your point in the article.
And they're not accepting it. It's also factually, they are not accepting it for future generations. God is telling them that the Torah that I'm giving to you is not just for everybody here, but for all generations. So it's not a matter of, that has nothing to do with their statement that we're going to do and we're going to listen.
Right.
People in line have a hard time hearing. They're saying that actually Tina is saying the audio is okay. I'm just wondering if anybody knows how you adjust the input of the mic on the computer to increase the volume of the input, not the output. Are you familiar with that, Josh?
What was the question?
How to increase the input volume of a microphone attached to a PC.
Well, they wouldn't really need the input volume, right? I mean, you think the...
Actually, Tina is saying that the audio is okay because I'm seeing online that the Sharon is mentioning that the audio is very low. So I guess, Sharon, what you should do is try to increase your speaker volume. But Tina, you're saying it's okay. Laura, what about you? How's the volume? Is it sufficient? Is it good? Let me see if she writes back on that. To your controller here. I just have the audio. But I did notice in the past that the volume was the bars on the audio device were actually higher than they are now. I'm not sure why. Looks like it's showing more. No, I'm not sure. How's the sound for people online right now? Just made some changes. So Tina and Laura, if you just tell me before we, I don't want to start the class unless we know for sure the sound's working. Okay, they're saying it's okay now online. All right, good. Okay. So let's hope the it was just a temporary glitch. All right, let me just do a test one more time. I'm just doing a test 1, 2, 3. Just keep you right on screen how the 1, 2, 3 sounds. All right, just put in 1, 2, 3 on the message on the screen so I know that you're responding to that, and then we'll start. Cal and Doug, log on yet or no? Okay. So we'll draw a little bit later.
You know, now that I think about it, I don't remember seeing the reminder for Doug's class tonight, so maybe they're gone.
Okay. All right, well, we'll put it online anyway, so they can hear it later. All right. So let's go. So last week we spoke about verses Kehelet 7, and we went through verses 5 through 9. Okay, Sharon, Laura, Tina. Okay, good. So I'm glad the audio is okay now. Okay, Rivka, how does it sound for you? If you want to type on screen. And again, just you may also have to turn up your speaker volume and your control panels on your computer too. All right. So what we said last week was that when he talks about in 5:7-5, that it's better to listen to the ridicule, the critique, the shouting of the wise person, rather than being a person, than being a man who listens to the song of fools. So what we said there was that the person is looking for certain, you know, a soothing type of a enjoyment, something which is emotionally appealing. So that's why King Solomon has to correct the person and tell him it's better off than hearing people sing to you or just hear a singing. It's better off that you perfect yourself, that you hear the critique of an intelligent person. But then he explains in the next verse, and he says, because as is the voice of the crackling of the thorns under a pot, when you're cooking food, then you use wood as your fuel, and the wood might have thorns in it, so the thorns crackle. So those crackling sounds of the thorns, that's also like the laughter of fools. I mean, if you're a person that's trying to just joke around and pursue that as your speech, so your speech and your laughter is equivalent to the crackling of the thorns, which is a very short-lived thing, and it really doesn't do anything for you. So that minimal amount of time that you're involved in something which is emotionally fun, it's really just like the crackling of the thorns that actually it destroys it. The crackling of the thorn comes from the fire consuming it, and then it's a very short-lived thing, and it actually is part of the destruction of the thorn. So also, when a person's involved, is engaged in just laughter, that's to his destruction. Because what he's doing is he's venting the emotion of just satisfying, you know, certain instinctual needs to joke around, to make somebody else laugh, or to get a good laugh himself. So if a person tries to engage in that area, so the emotions will become more attached to that, less attached to wisdom. So that's why he says that that's a destruction to the person, just like the thorn, when it makes its noise, but the fire is destroying it. So also a person who is engaging in foolish speech and laughter is doing the same thing. Okay. And then he explains why this is. We said there was a progression to these verses. So he says, now he explains philosophically why this is not good for a person, because he says in 7 that the oppression, the person who oppresses his intelligence in order to be involved in laughter and joking, so this is now going to destroy the gift that was given to him, meaning the heart that was given as a gift, the intelligence that was given as a gift. Okay, so that type of When you remove yourself from being involved, Sforno says, in wisdom, so of course you're hurting yourself. So he now shows you philosophically what is what the harm is. And then we said verse 8 is now the rule. What's the rule? He says that better is the latter end of something than its beginning. Better is the latter end of something than its beginning. And also, it is better to be patient than to be proud. Now, this is where I want to bring in, I think, an important statement. Now, there's just one thing which we did not say last week on this verse. And that is, why are both ideas in this one verse? You could have had one verse that gave his rule. Because the basic idea that he's trying to show you through all the series of these verses is that the person who's making the wrong decision in life is doing so because he's looking for the immediate, the here and now. He's looking for the satisfaction right away. So he goes for the laugh and he goes for the song. He doesn't realize, though, that if he would restrain himself in certain cases, that would be better for him in terms of his perfection, his soul, his wisdom. He'd grow much. He would have a spurt of growth in terms of if he didn't engage in just foolishness, but use that time to be involved in thought and wisdom. So that would be a great benefit, a great boon to him and to his soul. But people do function with an instant gratification approach. So because of that, that's why King Solomon now gives you the rule. And he tells you the better is the latter end than the beginning. Because something might be appealing initially. And one of the commentators gave an example. It says certain foods might be very sweet at the beginning, but then they can hurt you in terms of disease at the end. Whereas certain medicines might be very bitter when you first take it, but the result will be healing. So they give that as an analogy. And we said this before, that the outcome of something, the person doesn't live in a moment. The person lives in a frame of time. And really, what the outcome of something, like the rabbis say in the Pirkei Avos, who's a wise person? The person who knows the outcome. I mean, he doesn't make assessments when he sees it immediately, right in the moment, but he waits, he's patient. You see two personality examples of this. When Joseph was telling the dreams over to his brothers, so his father rebuked him. But it also says in the verses that his father watched the matter. He waited. He was patient. I mean, he didn't just judge Joseph on the immediate when he was telling over. He ridiculed him because he says, the 11 sheaves and the 11 stars and the sun and the moon, meaning the 11 stars are the 11 brothers, and the sun and the moon is your mother and your father. They're all bowing to you, but your mother's dead. So he was trying to mitigate the jealousy that the brothers would have by Joseph parading around with this thing. He's saying that you're all going to bow to me. He didn't realize what he was doing at such a young age of 17. But nonetheless, his father saw something going on, so he ridiculed in order to try to control the situation, damage control. If he could show that the dream is really nothing, maybe the brothers wouldn't vent their jealousy. At the same time, he watched the matter. What's going to happen? Maybe there is something here. There is a person who's patient. He waits for the latter end of something, whereas Haman, as soon as he had an opportunity, he jumped to the front. He gave advice to King Ahasuerus. You got to kill your wife, and you can't let this happen. So he was very impetuous. So that shows a lack of wisdom. That's just a need to jump to the front and want to have the spotlight. Okay, but you see what is going on here is that Koheles, that King Solomon, is not just giving you an example and telling you how to work with a specific case. Meaning, when he says that oppression of the intelligence, just so you, I mean, if you restrain the intelligence, just so you can get some enjoyment from some joking around. So that's not good. But he doesn't want to leave it at just any one specific case. Because when you only have one case, so then you only have one application to what he's saying. You can see it's true, and the next time the same situation comes up, you'll be on guard and you can follow it. But without extracting or deducing a rule from what he's saying, you're not going to be able to apply the lesson in more areas in life. And of course, it's a greater benefit that a person can derive a lesson, can derive a rule, and then he'll be able to detect when other cases come up. So if He just tells you that you shouldn't restrain your pursuits of wisdom for the sake of just some joking around or wasting time, a nonsense. So that if that's all he tells you, so that's the only case you can apply it to. But if he tells you better off is the latter end than the beginning, so now I can apply it to other cases. Now he's giving me a rule. And now when I'm in this case in the future and some people are joking around, I could say, I remember what King Solomon said. Better off is the latter end of something than the beginning. So I might be able to joke around now, but isn't this going to take away from time that I could really be studying? So he'll be able to apply himself there. But then he may be a week later or a day later, he may be invited for a big, big feast and he sees all the food and everything. And now he gets the food looks great, it looks delicious. But if I eat too much now, I might suffer the consequences later on and put on the weight and build up my cholesterol. So now he can apply the King Solomon's rule to another case. And of course, you can see now how many cases he can apply this wisdom. And he could benefit in many instances as opposed to being, as opposed to just benefiting in one case. So it, what I want to bring out is that when you have a rule, now you can apply something that's good for you in many areas of your life. Because then you'll be able to detect, you'll associate back. What I'm about to encounter now, that's similar. Because the mind will make associations and it will see the pattern. And whatever you had learned in terms of a rule, you'll be able to apply it in a broader set of cases than if you just are being taught a specific instance. All right, does everybody see that?
Yeah.
Right, makes sense? Okay. All right. Now, last week, so Francesca had a question, so we talked back and forth. It's actually in the Jewish Times, but there's something which I was thinking about this morning that, of course, I couldn't have put in. And that is, we were talking about the difference of opinion in terms of Aristotle, Plato, and Maimonides on creation. So we basically, the difference is very clear. And, of course, the Torah's view is that God created everything from nothingness. Aristotle's view is that God didn't really will anything. The universe is as a shadow is to a person, so is the universe to God. And the way it is now is the way it has always been in this state. Okay, so there really wasn't any will by God. It was and it's also eternal. The universe is eternal, according to Aristotle, as it is now in its finished state. Plato takes the middle road where he says the universe is not eternal, but matter is eternal. There always was some chaotic or unformed matter, but then God did take that matter and form it into the universe that we see today. Okay. Now, there's actually, what I'll do is, if somebody remind me after the class, I should remember, but I found a pretty good paper that somebody wrote that goes into this and gives his own assessment. He has some statements which are not, wise statements. They're his own points. But in general, he does cull a lot of the opinions and dealing with Aristotle and Plato in one paper. So it's good for that. It's good in terms of that. So I'll make an HTML and put that this way you can actually read it yourself. It is an interesting read. And he does a pretty good job. But we were discussing yesterday is what's the reason for Aristotle's opinion? And what is Maimonides' critique? What is Rambam's critique on it? Why doesn't Rambam agree with it? Because Rambam says openly in the Guide to the Perplexed that we don't have one proof either way to the eternity of the universe or to the creation. It's based on the Torah. But it's not a logical proof, but it is a historical proof, because once we know that there was a revelation at Sinai, so now we know that this Torah that was given to us is from this God, and we know everything in it is true. So we know it based on authority, based on prophecy. So that's why we know the creation took place from nothingness. But in Maimonides' critique on Aristotle and Plato, and he says that these are the philosophers. The problem that they had was that they were too materialistic. Their view was too materialistic. What does he mean? He means that And there's a chapter in the guide, which is a very good chapter. He says that people make a mistake, and that's to this point in King Solomon. He says people will look at something in the current state, the way it's designed right now, that you could look at, specifically Aristotle and Plato, they'll look at the universe the way it is now, and based on the way it is now, they say that these were the laws that existed at its inception, or as it was prior, because they don't say there was an inception. They say that matter was always there. So you know, Maimonides, Rambam, he critiques them on this and says there's no reason you must say that. And the critique is because he's saying that Aristotle and Plato, and it's clear, it's true what he's saying, that what they're doing is they're looking at the way the world operates now and says it must always have been this way. So let's just open this up a little bit. But you see how he gave a rule. What the important thing is, and hopefully I'll remember to come back and reiterate it again, but the important thing that Maimonides did was he didn't just show that they were wrong on this act of on creation and the existence of the universe. Maimonides, in his guide, extrapolates a rule in order that, again, like just like King Solomon gave us a rule, that the person should not assess something at its beginning, but the end, meaning how things pan out. Then there's more information. Now you can really see what the result is. Then you really understand the truth about something. Don't assess something right at the beginning. So this is to the same point, that Aristotle and Plato had assessed what the beginning of the world was based on how it is now. So what do they look at now? So specifically Aristotle, according to this paper, the author wrote that according to Aristotle, there's two things you really have to consider. Matter and time. So what was time according to Maimonides? Time was a creation. Without any matter, there's no such thing as time because there's nothing that's changing. Time is a measurement of change in the physical, according to Maimonides. All right, so he actually says it was a creation. Time was created by God. According to Aristotle, that's not true. He defines time as being a series of moments, right? And what does he say a moment is? A moment is something which had it before and it had it after. Meaning it's part of a series. So Aristotle has this position where a moment is something which had a before and it had an after. So if that's true, so there was a previous moment before the moment right now. Right now it's 11:42 in New York. So that means 11:41. There had to be an 11:41. In order that I could talk about the moment that I'm in, there was a previous moment and there's going to be a subsequent moment. And time is the collection of all these moments. That's what he defines as time. Simple explanation. But you see, what happens is that you can never get to the beginning of time, according to him, because every moment is going to demand that there's another time before it and another moment of time afterwards. All right? And since that's so, therefore you have an infinite series. Now, he also has this concept of motion, where motion is something which only exists because something else acted on it. So I have something in my hand. I'll call it D. So D is now moving. So my hand is moving D. So that means something had to move my hand, which came before that. That was C. C is now something, so the muscle or an impulse in my brain. Something had to create my brain. That's the previous thing, B. Meaning everything which is in motion had to be set in motion by something prior to it. There had to be something prior to it. And therefore, says Aristotle, that you'll never have a first moment. You always have, it goes back in time infinitely. So that's why he says that the eternity of the universe. I'm not sure Plato how he weighs in on this, but just taking that position. But the flaw that Aristotle has is that he's looking at how the beginning must be based on how he sees the universe functioning in its current state. And Maimonides says clearly there's nothing which demands that you must say that. And he gives an example, and he shows how you have a story. He gives an example of a boy who grows up without his mother, and is on an island, and his father, and there's no women, I think, is part of the story. And he asks his father how they get here, and so on and so forth. And his father tells him, well, at a certain time, you were small and you're inside the stomach of this thing called a woman, and there was no air and it was dark and you're there for 9 months. So the boy would respond, how is it possible? If I would not have any air right now, for even a few moments, I would die. And if I would not be able to excrete my waste, I would die. And you're telling me that for 9 months, I didn't breathe, I didn't have any excretion. And this would be ludicrous, because the boy is basing his creation on what he looks at right now. So Maimonides says, so too, the universe. You can't say, based on how you see it now, how it was at the outset. See, he gives a beautiful example and shows you how there was a mistake that they made. And that's why he says they were too materialistic. They looked at what the material of the world and the laws that function now, and they said, oh, this is how it must have been at the beginning. And since all these laws had to be in place, and motion works a certain way, so, and something has to make something else move, and that thing had to have something moving it prior to it, and so on and so forth. So time and motion are infinite, and they go back in time infinitely, eternally. Right, so that's where, since you see now how they're looking at something, just like King Solomon is saying, that if you look at, you assess something based on the here and now, but you don't give it time, you don't look at it at the latter end, so you're going to have false conclusions. That's why a thing is better off as a thing at the latter end than it is at the beginning. So it's similar to this, but what the similarity really I'm trying to bring out is that there's a rule, and you see that what Maimonides did is that he extracted a rule. He didn't just leave the statement that Aristotle is wrong on creation, but he wanted to show you where it was coming from. Now that you have a rule, you can see how this can be applied in other areas. All right? So the rule, let's just take it slow now. So the rule, we said by Kohelis, by King Solomon, is that don't assess something too quickly. Okay. More information can be made available if you wait, if there's patience, if you look into it more, if you investigate. Now the rule here by Maimonides is not just to leave creation as being just rejecting Aristotle's view on creation or the existence of the universe, but that he goes in and he analyzed what is it that motivated him to do this? What error precipitated this false statement that Aristotle made? So he said because they're materialistic. They allowed that to infiltrate their thinking. They couldn't extricate themselves from that. Now, is that due to the fact that Maimonides had the transmission from the Torah, which they didn't perhaps have? Or is it because the mind has a capability, divorced from it, whether Maimonides had the Torah or not, maybe the mind has the capability to be much more creative. His mind was much more excelled than Aristotle and Plato. See, he was able to think outside of the box more. He wasn't restricted by what he saw. That really is a great mind, where you may see things in the world, you may see the world operate a certain way, but Maimonides' mind, he was able to explore things further. Well, who says this is the way it had to be always? So I don't know where it came from, but his insight and his point is correct, and you see that he's able to go outside of the framework of how the physical world works, which he's critiquing Plato and Aristotle that they were not able to. But still, nonetheless, Maimonides does refer to Aristotle as being like a level below prophecy. He had the greatest praise for Aristotle. But we're just talking about one point. This should not cast any shadow on you know, I'm sure the thousands of other points that Aristotle had in his life. I mean, he's known by the world to be a genius. All right, let me stop here and see if there's any questions or comments at this point.
It makes a lot of sense, Rabbi.
Good, good. And I actually started looking through those chapters. It's in the second book, around chapter 19, 20, 23, 25. You'll see what I'll do is I'll send an email out, so this way you can see the actual article, and you can extract and see where he's quoting from the guide. And it's just very good, because in just one paper, you have, you know, all these different parts, the critique and his position, and even shows how, you know, even today, Hubble has not disproven Maimonides. So he was the writer is an honest writer, but you see some of his own personality coming in there, and he's throwing some of his own words. That was not, he was not being objective in those points. When you're presenting ideas, you just stick to the ideas. Okay.
Rabbi, could I say something?
Yes.
Yeah, please. I just wanted to go back to what you said before. That was such an excellent point about the child who was trying to judge based on his knowledge of now, and he couldn't possibly comprehend that he was able to breathe and survive for the 9 months. If we just think about that and apply it in other areas, it would help to enlighten us in so many different ways, and it's such a beautiful point. I just wanted to comment on that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good. It's in the Guide to the Perplexed. I'm not sure which chapter it is.
Yeah,
yes.
It just opened up my head when I heard it. It's such a great point,
right.
And it applies to so many things in life.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, so see how important it is to actually have a rule. I'm just wondering out loud, so where would we be able to apply Maimonides' rule here now? What would be another application of his critique that they were too materialistic in terms of their assessment of the operation of the world? Meaning that any type of anything which you see now, it doesn't necessarily mean that, meaning it doesn't have to just be material. It could be other things that we perceive that we derive from behavior of man too. I mean, the design of man. We see that prior to the sins, so there was no such thing as embarrassment. There was no such thing as morality. That's why Adam and Eve were able to be unclothed and there was no embarrassment. It says that openly in the Torah. So you see that there was a different state than just the human psyche at a certain point. That at least we have historical account of that. But I'm wondering if this rule is specifically about a comparison of the now to the before. I'm just wondering if there's any other application. Like, for example, Kohelis's rule is that never to be too hasteful, shouldn't be too hasty in terms of assessing something. It means the person is trying to have an immediate assessment, or he wants to live in the here and now. That, I mean, there's an emotion that pushes him to do that, but he has to conquer that. And if he really wants to have the right appreciation, the right understanding of something, you can't just judge something based on a small element. It's like a person looking at a, if a person only saw the tail of an animal and nothing else, so he'd make wrong conclusions about what the whole animal is. All right, so that would be a similar type of application. So the rule over there is to have as much information and also to restrain the emotions from trying to be too quick. Because that's what's part of, that's why he says that in the same verse, in, you see, that's why I'm glad I almost forgot this. If you look at verse 7-8, when he says the rule, he doesn't end the verse there. He says, better is the end of a thing than its beginning. But he throws into the very same verse, better is it to be patient than to be proud, than pride, or haughty, arrogance. Why does he put it in the same verse? I was wondering. Perhaps because it's more integral than the other rules. Because you see that the next verse, he continues on the theme. He says, don't be too excited in your spirit to be angry. because anger really sits in the bosom of fools. That's part of the identity of a fool, that he's angry and he's too quick. Because of his anger, he can try to do things. But again, that's more of an example, but more central to the rule that something at his latter end, that's better off than its beginning, meaning in terms of assessing the truth of something, wait, be patient. But something which is integral to that ability is the human condition of controlling your pride and being patient. Perhaps that's why he puts it in the same verse. He's trying to show you that patience is integral to following this rule. So he puts both of these statements in one verse to teach you that this point about better off to be patient than to be proud and be arrogant or be too quick, that human quality is more integral to having the right assessment of truth in life than other things. Meaning this is really where the problem comes from. It's a person who, like Haman, who's too proud and arrogant, he wants to give an answer really quick. It's the person who's patient, like Jacob, and he waited and he watched the matter. He stored it in his heart. He didn't want to make an assessment immediately. There's no reason to. So he was patient. So you see what I think that King Solomon is showing you, but putting these two things together in one verse, as Rabbi Shade explained, we have a tradition that whenever you have a number of ideas in one verse, they're related. And there's more relationship than things that are outside that verse. So you have to ask yourself the question, why in the single verse over here didn't he just give me the rule? Better off is the latter end of something than the beginning. No, he wanted to show you that I have to put one more thing in this verse. And what is that? Patience is better than pride. Because patience is integral to following this rule. If you don't have patience, then you can't ever get to the latter end to make the assessment. You'll be too quick to judge. Right? Everybody see that? I think it's an important point. Just in terms of appreciation of how King Solomon is structuring the verse and a method by which we can use this. Again, here's another rule. Things that are together in one verse are more related than things that are outside the verse. That's why it's one verse. It's one idea. When the idea is concluded, then we end off and start another verse. So here again is a third rule that we're getting today. All right, so now the rule will be something which we can apply this now in every other verse that we learn. If we would have just shown that patience and arrogance is more integrally related to the rule, then that's one idea. Where can you go with that? You can't really apply that anywhere else. It's a self-contained lesson. If I tell a child, don't eat chocolate, it's bad for your teeth, so they'll eat other things that are candy. But if I say to the child, don't eat too much candy, now they can apply a general principle to more instances in life. Okay, and you see that's what Maimonides does and what King Solomon does, that the rule is important because they want to benefit the reader. How is the sound online? Laura, Sharon, Tina, let me know how the sound is because I can't really assess it from here. The bar is on the recording device and not going too high, but I just want to see if the sound is all right. Okay. Okay, Laura, good. Glad you see the idea. It's an important idea. It's one of, you know, many, but, you know, the fact that we can get to this point and isolate and articulate the concept of having a rule as opposed to just having a singular lesson, now we can keep focus on that. And now what we can even do further is to continually look for rules. You see, if we can universalize more, so now we'll give, not only will we have a better appreciation of the world, of the universe and God, but then we'll have a benefit of having a lesson that can be applied in many facets of our day. Okay, Tina, Sharon, good. I'm glad the sound is good. right. That's what I wanted to present for today. We still have a few more minutes. So if anybody has questions on taking on this topic or other, I'd be more than happy to do that. Just to we have a few more minutes. We can discuss if you have something in your mind.
So, Rabbi?
Yep. Go ahead, Francesca.
So, the rule is you have a result of something, and it may not be the way it started. I'm still thinking about it.
Yes, exactly. Meaning, not the result of something, but what the person sees now, how something behaves. The laws that pertain to something right now does not necessarily mean that they were the same laws that existed at the inception, at the beginning of something. There's nothing causing us to say that. It's only because a person has a sense of, it's now, it was this way now, it was this way yesterday, it hasn't changed, I haven't seen any change, so therefore there wasn't any change ever. But that's a big jump. We can see why a person's motivated to do that, because they don't see change over a certain, smaller period of time. But then they try to extrapolate to the entire life of the existence of something. I mean, the universe is billions of years old. So what's to say that matter had the same properties at the beginning? So that's what the critique was. That Maimonides is saying about Plato and Aristotle that they had too much of a materialistic view and they couldn't get past that. And they made a wrong conclusion.
Isn't it true that the scientists today, what they fairly recently come up with the Big Bang Theory and stuff like this really confirms Maimonides' view that, that matter really wasn't, just like energy and the same laws didn't really apply, in the scientific model today.
You're saying that they admit today that they can't really assess what happened the second before creation?
Yeah, I'm not an expert in it, but it seems to be...
Yeah, that's the consensus. They agree to that because the scientists realize, scientists know that the laws of science can only be applied to after creation. But prior to creation, you can't make any type of guess what's going on because you have... The laws stop at that point.
Yeah.
So they admit that, right? So the consensus is against Aristotle and Plato. Yes. It's an important rule. All right, think it over. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put, I'll send an email out to the Noahide list. If anybody online right now is not on the Noahide list and you want to be, you don't have to be Noahide, of course. But the way you can subscribe to it is send an email to, is it Plural? I think it's Noahides. -on@mesorah.org. So that will subscribe you. You can send the email. It's either, I think it's Noahides-on. You put a hyphen and then O-N @mesorah.org. That'll put you onto the list if you're not there already. And then I'll send out a link with this paper so you could read through it. And I think you'll enjoy it. It's pretty much well done. Except for his comments and his guesswork at Maimonides, and when he tries to attribute his own thinking about Maimonides' motivation. We don't do that, and Judaism has a law against that, where you're not supposed to be suspicious about your teachers. You learn, and if you have a disagreement, you disagree on the point. you don't start looking for motivations or psychological, you know, needs that we're trying to be catered to, or agendas, which you'll see in one part of this paper. He wanted to say that Maimonides secretly accepted Plato's view that matter was eternal, which is ridiculous. So that's something which is completely wrong. But he says that Maimonides openly didn't say that because he wanted to root everybody and anchor them in the Jewish religion, so he wanted to give them something which was no gray area. So you'll see that you have to dismiss statements like that, but that doesn't mean the other statements we have to trash. Right? It's just good to have everything in one spot. But then look at the sources if you want in the guide. Laura, the spelling is without a C. Noah Hides, -on at Mesora.org. Okay, there's no C in there. So if you send an email to Noah Hides, -on at Mesora.org, that'll subscribe you. Okay. All right, so we'll wrap up here. We'll pick up next week, and I'll send the email out in a few moments. This way everybody can take a look at that, all right? And again, any questions during the week, please, you know, feel free. You can email. And it doesn't have to be just a once-a-week interaction. So if there's anything that comes up, let me know, please. All right, so have a good week, everybody.
Okay, thanks.